Jenny Valentich was researching a book about addiction and substance abuse and noticed something curious. Some people who treated drug taking like an Olympic sport as users would, upon getting sober, hurl themselves into another extreme pursuit like marathon running, boxing or bodybuilding. So she decided to find out why some people are so all or nothing. Her new book gives us a window into the experiences of people who push their boundaries to the limit. A female bare-knuckle boxer, a scientist testing his disgust response by eating what most would consider to be inedible, and a former crack user now addicted to ultramarathon running. Jenny's had personal experience in this sphere too. After getting sober, she took up Thai kickboxing, which soon became an obsession. Jenny Valentich was with 9 to Noon talking about her first book on addiction, and we welcome her back to discuss everything harder than everyone else. Jenny, hi, welcome.
Morning, Catherine, and yeah, thanks for having me back on. Oh, croaky voice already, it's too early here.
Oh, fair enough. It's a Metallica song you've riffed off there for the title. We were going to play it, but we got a bit busy with a breaking news story this morning.
It's got a good rhythm to it, hasn't it? It's actually Motorhead. They had an album, Everything Louder Than Everyone Else.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, Everything Harder Than Everyone Else really sums up the attitude of a lot of the people in my book. They're really interested in being outliers and pushing themselves further than their peers.
Tell me about your thought journey with it. It was while writing the addiction memoir that you got interested in this. Was it just playing away as you were writing? Was it just playing away in the side of the brain, if you like? What was it you kept seeing?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between the people I've profiled in the book who push their bodies to extremes and I think people who are sometimes drawn to drug addiction and alcohol addiction. There's that obsessive nature. There's the real goal-oriented behaviour, you know, like the acquisition of a drug is thought to almost be more of a high than the drug itself. And the people I've interviewed in this book are, you know, all about breaking goals and pushing themselves. And there's also the idea of controlling the body. I think some people with drug use are really exploring regaining control of the body and their sense of endurance as well and what they can withstand. So there's a lot of similarities. So one of my interviewees, Charlie Engel, he's a 60-year-old ultramarathon runner. He's had documentaries made about him. He's written a memoir. He does these epic races. He even has to invent his own because no other race can hold him. But he used to be very much into crack cocaine as a young man. He used to have his car shot at by dealers. He'd go on benders for days and wake up with all his possessions missing. And he told me he really sees the similarities between that and what he does now. And he says part of it's kind of an ego thing, you know, because when he used to buy crack from dealers, they'd say, "Steady on, Charlie, you're not going to take that much, are you?" Whereas now, you know, he'll tell people about his 5-day run across the Sahara Desert and he gets kind of the same response. So he says a lot of it's about validation and just wanting to be that one step harder than everybody else.
There's the artificial stimulant through taking something, but there's also the natural stimulant. And did Charlie and did others talk about what the natural chemical response would be to some of the stuff they took on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm speaking from experience as well, doing a sport like Muay Thai kickboxing. You know, you feel like after a really, really good session, you know, these chemicals blow through you like a bracing gale. And it's a different kind of high, but it is undeniably a high. I mean, you're releasing, you know, things to combat the pain you're feeling. So you've got these endocannabinoids, you've got these kind of opioids, you've got dopamine, you've got serotonin. You're basically like a human vending machine of good feelings. So that's definitely something that can attract people as well.
Tell me a little bit about the Muay Thai journey and how this progressed from the addiction that you wrote about so eloquently in the first book and then the reasons for starting with Muay Thai in the first place and then how it... I mean, it's really interesting how it even begins, right? It's sort of like old life kind of legacies into new life. You were due to make a police statement, I think, about an historic crime. And tell me what was happening in your life at this point that leads you through to this new passion.
Well, it goes back to control again, because I, as you say, was having to make this police statement. I was having to do it in the UK. It was going to be a process that would be quite long that I didn't have any control over, and a distressing one. And I just tend to project manage my way out of any kind of crisis or distressing situation. So I thought, what can I do? I don't have any control over this situation. Well, I can control my body. And I thought I would take up this particularly aggressive sport, also as a form of anger management. You know, over the next 2 years, I saw my body change into something really strong and sinewy. I wouldn't say I have mastery over the sport, but I've definitely become more masterful over the sport, and that's a really empowering feeling. And then I wound up doing my first amateur fight literally a week before the book went to the printer. It was quite funny with the timing. And the feeling of, you know, stepping through the ropes and doing three rounds in front of a crowd of thousands of people who are quite boozed up by this point and boisterous makes you feel like you can withstand anything. So that's a commonality with the people in my book. They've often, at some point in their life, felt really, really vulnerable or embattled, and they found something, whatever it is, be it going to a BDSM dungeon, be it fighting, be it bodybuilding, they found something that has scored some sense of victory for themselves on the one hand, but also makes them feel like they can withstand anything that daily life throws at them. So it's almost like they're constantly pressure testing themselves with whatever their pursuit is to make sure that they're still strong.
And that's different from a sense of self-punishment or self-flagellation, right? That's a different motivation.
Well, I would say they can coexist, actually. I mean, with the self-punishment and self-flagellation, which, again, you see a lot of people who take drugs, that's a common one for ultra running, which I can't wrap my head around, really, because ultra running is really long-standing damage to the body, and, you know, a race can take days. You could be literally running for days. So the mental grit you would need for that is astonishing. And I do think ultra running does have, from the people I've spoken to, there is a sense of like using it to purge and using it to self-flagellate. But also, I mean, again, you are, if you can run that race through a desert or through terrible conditions, then you basically strip yourself to the essence and you really meet yourself, and nothing is going to see. Things like comments on the internet or whatever silly things are going on in your day-to-day life just aren't going to seem important anymore.
You found a big overreach, a big crossover, a big overlap between former drug use and ultramarathon running. I suppose it also, it takes up time. It distracts, and I'm not sure how much of this is relevant or how many of the people raise the issue of whether they still struggle with their addictive urges, and that some of these enterprises or passions they've thrown themselves into help them deal with that.
Definitely, yeah, because it becomes a new obsession. These are generally people who have like a one-track mind. I don't want to talk about people like I'm pathologizing, by the way, because I count myself as one of them. But, you know, they're kind of the natural born leg jigglers, I would call them, people who really need mine's jiggling as we speak, people who really need a focus, somewhere to put that energy, and they found something that can replace drug use. So it works really well, actually. And to me, these are people that used to get celebrated in song in centuries of yore, you know. So they're the outliers, they're the people who just do things other people couldn't, wouldn't or shouldn't, and I admire them for that.
I might go early to something you discuss at the end of the book, before we meet some more of these fascinating characters that you've written about, people that you've written about, because there was another element to this, and you talk about the void chasers, and also sometimes coming out of an addiction, you don't know who you are, like the kind of the identity crisis or the loss of sense of self. Could you speak a little bit more to that, either from your own experience or from what others told you, that kind of transition point?
Yeah, definitely. If you think about athletes, professional athletes, they've got really short careers, but within that career, they have to 100% attach themselves to what it is they do. They have to be very selfish. You know, they probably don't have as many close relationships as other people or a social life. So they are their sport, essentially. And increasingly in sports psychology, psychologists are looking at the danger of that, because when you retire, that's when you can completely, your life can fall apart because you don't have your identity anymore. So, you know, a lot of sports people might fall into addiction or, you know, something really kind of unhealthy, or just experience depression, you know. And so in sports psychology, there's a real emphasis on broadening your sense of who you are. So you're not just a footballer, you know, you're also an uncle, you're someone who enjoys this and that. And if you look at athletes' social media bios, increasingly I'm seeing them not just say footballer, but like a whole list of things. And you think, oh, I think you've been talking to a professional. But it relates to all of us, I think, because personally, you know, whenever I finish a big project like a book, which I've completely thrown myself into, I'm completely bereft. I don't know where to go. I'm kind of floating around. And it's not until I find the next idea and hurl myself into it that I feel better again. And similarly with people like ultra runners, they told me between races, they can get into binge eating and depression, and overtraining and just going to the gym at midnight, just, you know, to try and tame the squirrels in their brain. And it's not until they start planning the next race that they feel better. And I think we could probably all relate to that to an extent, because we've all, during the pandemic, had, you know, a loss of identity to an extent. You know, maybe we lost a job, maybe we're not able to do the pursuit that we are known for as much as before. And so I think we can all feel a bit adrift and like we've lost touch with ourselves. So the last chapter of the book looks at ways around that.
It does. And we'll just touch on one more piece before we come back, if you wouldn't mind. But you talk about there's a moment needed. You've talked about various stages of your life where you can relate to this. But you've talked about the need to hit pause and look inwards. If you're making a major transition, particularly if you're coming out of an addiction, if you don't have some kind of hit pause moment, the risk is you kind of repeat, instead of doing something that is going to be better for you or healthy for you, that you repeat whatever it is you're trying to kick. Can you explain more?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really goes to the idea of cross addiction, which is when your brain is, when your reward system in your brain is very highly revved, like you've been, you know, using maybe a stimulant drug, for instance. If you suddenly take that away, then your brain is casting around looking for something to replace it. And the temptation, of course, is to hurl yourself into something else without doing the necessary work on what lies beneath, you know, the emotional pain that lies beneath. A good example would be often if you were to go to a 12-step group, say like NA, you might find the stereotype is that people can often like hurl themselves into sex and using it as a pickup. It's because they've given up one thing and they go straight into another. So, yeah, it's just a comment on pausing to look at what lies beneath.
Let's look at the Muay Thai, isn't it? Sorry, I think I was pronouncing the cocktail earlier, which probably tells you a thing or two about me.
It's Muay Thai and then Mai Thai is the cocktail.
So tell me a little bit more. Again, we talked about how you began. Again, I'm not sure if this was part of researching the book or, again, was a revealing moment for you, but you do plenty of sparring. But then we meet Sir James, who's an interesting character for all sorts of reasons. And frankly, you seem to have a bit of a thrashing when you get in the ring with him. But tell us a little bit more about him as a character and as one of these people who speak to your thesis in the book.
Sir James is a male dom, so he's a dominant, he's a sex worker. And look, to be completely honest, I was going to go and see him as a Christmas present to myself. And then I thought, hang on, you're writing a book about endurance. You should interview him and claim this back at tax time. So that's what I did. he works in a fetish, it's called Fetish House. It's a dungeon in Melbourne. And he was delighted to be interviewed because he's given it a lot of thought to why people come and see him. So I just, he basically, there's almost like a shopping list of things that you can choose that he does. So we discussed beforehand what I would do. And I had a 90-minute session and then I interviewed him on another occasion. And I tell you what, you just feel like you can really let off steam, you know. It's a place where you've got permission to just go nuts. And again, you've got all these feel-good chemicals buzzing around your body, because he does things like impact play, and we did some wrestling. So it's weird. Like, you could just go there in your lunchtime, people would never know that you've just been rolling around the floor with someone wearing a wrestling costume. But he was talking about, again, this notion of people testing themselves. So, you know, he's got people who come to him and they literally want to be wrapped up in cling film or glad wrap or whatever you would call it, and left in a coffin with a breathing hole for an hour, which, you know, seems bizarre to me. But then they've just gone through this whole period of, I guess, panic and overcoming panic and feeling like they've survived something. And so they feel all the stronger for it. It's almost like having, to get topical, a vaccine, and that kind of, you know, preventing you against a future crisis.
Another really interesting person, the bodybuilder, Courtney Olsen. This again, and I think you've alluded to control. And for her, the bodybuilding, and you've mentioned this with the body as well, it's a way of having some control where one feels like they've never had it before, or have had others with control. Can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah, I found that so fascinating. So I found two female bodybuilders to basically shadow, Courtney Olsen being one. She's this amazing, larger-than-life character who is known for having the world's deadliest thighs, and she crushes watermelons between them, does it on TV and stuff, and she's got her own clothing company, Girl. But she and the other interviewees, I talked to them, both had the same story, as it turned out, which was they both had really chaotic childhoods, especially like inconsistent parenting from the mother, and they'd both been sexually abused. And I was thinking at first, oh, this is really inconvenient for me as a writer. You know, I found people who've got the same story. But the more women I talk to in bodybuilding, this is a really, really common story. And even some male bodybuilders, there's really famous ones like Kai Greene and Flex Wheeler, they also experienced sexual abuse as children. And if you think about it, you know, they've chosen a sport as an adult where they are building a superhero version of themselves. You know, they are their own savior. They're coming in and rescuing themselves. They've made an invincible body. They've built it. But also the chaotic childhood comes into it, in that if you never knew what was coming next as a kid, then of course it makes sense to, as an adult, maybe after going through your own chaotic 20s and 30s, to find a sport where it's so regimented, that it's all about calculating macros and micros, doing reps and sets at the gym. Your entire day would be broken down into segments. And there's such a kind of comfort and relief in that for people who've had that chaotic upbringing. So I really, really came to respect that, because I'd had that initial idea of our bodybuilders are just vain, you know, they're just primping and preening. And I don't find that to be true now.
It's not just the physical training or the sporting extremes. One of the really interesting characters was your scientist, a neuroscientist, Dr. Jack Alocca, is it?
Yes.
What is it that took him from being a bioengineer specialising in sleep research to eating things that most of us would just consider inedible? What was, how did he display, to sort of explain his rationale?
Jack's fascinating. He's in his 30s. He's Italian. He lives in Melbourne, though, and he's a respected neuroscientist and pharmacologist. But he's always had these personal missions. I actually met him through the Australian Psychedelic Society. And he, even among that kind of crowd, he stands out. Like, he wears a monocle. He has like this asymmetrical long hairstyle. He's just quite eccentric. And He has these two missions. One is to take as many psychoactive substances as possible, as in try as many that exist on this planet. The other is to eat as many species as possible, which is definitely polarizing readers. But, you know, what he does is he travels and he uses food as a gateway into these kind of remote communities, and he hunts with them, and he really gets into... Yeah, he gets more of an understanding of their lifestyle by eating the way they do. But it means he's eaten lots of endangered species. He's also eaten things like dog and cat, which is more about, in his words, disrupting you know, people's idea of morality. So he basically is just on a mission to eat the inedible and also test his own disgust response and his own idea of moral coding, and always be thinking about, why am I disgusted about this? Can I override it? So he treats himself as a human experiment, basically.
You also talk with people of the experience of having to stop doing something obsessively, which is, this is very interesting, where it's not a choice that one comes to, I suppose. But I'm thinking of Chloe, the ballet dancer, whose career came to an abrupt end when she became unwell. What did you learn from her and from others in this situation?
Yeah, so there was a famous dancer and choreographer, Martha Graham, who once said, a dancer dies twice and it's the first death that is more painful. And by that she means when you have to retire when you're around 30. So Chloe Bayliss was a really promising Australian dancer. She'd been accepted into the Washington Ballet School, and then she became seriously ill with Graves' disease. Sorry, no, it's Crohn's disease. My apologies. And she was basically in hospital for about a year. You know, her organs kept failing on her, so she had to give up dance, and she couldn't accept it for a long time because that was who she was. So, I mean, she's now actually a really quite famous actress in Australia. So she basically had to look at what her skill set was, break that down, and think about how that could apply to something new. And she realised that she loves taking direction, for instance. You know, she loved having a mentor in dancing. So it made sense that she would be drawn to something where she would be directed. And she also needed an emotional outlet, and because dancers aren't allowed to really express emotion, you know, verbally. You know, they're supposed to really dampen down any discomfort they're feeling, and that's part of the training in a way. But then she was able to express all that repressed emotion through performance, so she needed something that allowed her to do that as well, and acting was it.
Do you come, and I mean, it's crazy to even try and endeavour to understand addiction, because every human being is an addict to one degree or another. But when we're talking about people who have addictions that patently are harming their lives, and I say that because they've decided they want to stop them and they go through the extreme experience of trying to stop them, or at least stop using, are you left with a feeling that some of these personalities are the true story? In other words, are there addicts who, you know, don't try to do everything harder than everyone else? Was there an element of personality, or are you more drawn to the fact that it's often life experience and the mechanism of managing life experience, the sense of wanting to get control from a life that where control was taken from you? Are you left with any deeper insights into the nature of addiction itself?
Well, for a start, with this book, I was definitely drawn to pursuits which might attract someone with something to prove, you know. So I didn't choose things like swimming and tennis, where you probably just had a natural aptitude as a child, and then got better and better at it. I did choose sports and pursuits where people were drawn to it, often as adults, because it was a way of kind of a cathartic way of expressing themselves. Really, with addiction, it's often fueled by somebody who's very restless. I said natural born leg jigglers earlier, but you know, it could be anxiety, for instance. And there's often a need to self-soothe, or someone trying to fix themselves. And so I think, yeah, there's a lot of, it makes sense then to look at the people in the book who found these really creative ways of doing the same job. And they're always going to get people who say, you're just going to hurt yourself, you know. Why would you do this to yourself? But the fact is, they've just found ways that are more healthy and more creative of dealing with the same sense of restlessness and sometimes trauma. Hmm. So, yeah, you don't need to have necessarily trauma at the bottom of addiction, but often there is this kind of emotional pain or agitation.
How important is writing to you? Do you tend to write very singularly when you're in writing phase?
Well, I am very restless too, so I have to do, to be frank, when I was younger, I used to use speed to help me write, because speed gives you intense focus, and so it was a useful tool for me. Now I don't do that. I have to come up with alternatives. So I basically cafe hop, because I can't be in one spot for more than an hour. I get really restless, or I go from room to room to room. And I try and do most of it in the morning. Another great trick is to be on a train. So I live in the country outside Melbourne, and when I take a train in to do my Muay Thai, I take my laptop, because you can't move on the trains. There's that kind of forced focus. So for me, it's all about finding these tricks to harness that restlessness in my brain.
Well, there's been two cracking books out of it, for sure. In fact, I think there's been three books, hasn't there?
Yeah, three, and then an anthology making it four. Yeah.
Wonderful, Jenny. Enjoyed the last one too. Thanks very much. Jenny Valentish, Everything Harder Than Everyone Else, Why Some of Us Push Our Bodies to Extremes, is by Jenny Valentish.